This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The average credit card debt in Vermont is $9,667, nearly $10,000 just in credit card debt, not to mention student loans, car loans, mortgages, and all the other ways people find themselves spending money they don't have in the bank. Let me give you a couple other statistics. 47% of Vermonters have subprime credit. 34% of Vermont adults live paycheck to paycheck, and 21% spend more than their income. On the plus side, 44% of Vermont adults paid off their credit cards in full over the past year, so not everyone is facing a mounting credit card bill. Given those statistics, though, it's not a stretch to say that financial literacy is very, very important, and it's becoming more common to see it taught in high schools and colleges. But as financial tools have become more complicated, it's important to know good debt from bad debt, to know what affects your credit rating, and to know how to get back on track if you find yourself in the hole. Today on the program, we're going to look at debt and credit. We're joined now by John Pelletier, director of Champlain College's Center for Financial Literacy. He's also one of the principal leaders behind the Vermont Financial Literacy Task Force. John, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having me again, Jane.
Let's go through a couple of those statistics that I mentioned. That number, 47% of Vermonters who have subprime credit. Can you just explain what will give somebody some subprime credit?
Yeah, that comes from a report that is from the Corporation for Enterprise Development, or CFED. And it's I wish they were using FICO scores. They're using a different proprietary score from TransUnion, so the numbers are not the same. It can confuse people when you talk about numbers, so I won't.
Okay.
But what that basically is saying is that if you have subprime credit, the credit bureau has determined, based on your actual historical behaviors, that you're not a very good credit risk. There's a likelihood that's higher than other people that you won't be able to pay back that debt. And so once you fall into low credit and subprime credit, when you can get credit, you're going to pay a lot more in interest rate. So whether that's a mortgage, whether that's an automobile loan, or a credit card debt, any revolving debt, they're going to charge you more.
And why is it that people are finding themselves with subprime credit? Is it more likely that they've defaulted on other payments or are paying bills late? Or, you know, what are the factors that are going into that for the majority of people?
Yeah, a lot of it could be for some folks just marginally bad behavior. That could push you down. It could be not paying your bills on time. It could be paying bills late. So, you know, if you have a credit card debt, I think based on one study or survey that I've seen of Vermonters, about 18%, so nearly, you know, one in five, are charged over the last year a late payment fee. And then on top of that, almost another 10% are charged, you know, kind of additional fees for bad credit card behavior. So it could be a late loan payment, a late mortgage payment. Any of those things.
If you have a high balance on your credit card and it's pretty close to the maximum that you have on that card and you're just paying off the minimum every month and so you're not actually working down that debt, is that going to affect your credit score as well?
Yeah. What people don't understand is because a lot of times they'll say, oh, I've got a credit problem. I should get rid of my credit card. That may not be a great thing to do because there's a variety of different factors that go into what's called your FICO score, which is used by 90% of lenders out there. And one of them is your carrying capacity of debt, which is the difference between your total amount of debt. So maybe I have a $5,000 credit line on my credit card and I'm at $4,500 in debt owed. That only leaves me a cushion of $500. That person isn't going to look as good as the person who has only $1,000 of debt on that credit card because their cushion of additional credit is $4,000. So being right up against your credit limit makes you a bad credit risk, not a good one.
So subprime lending on mortgages was, as we now know, one of the biggest contributing factors to the financial crisis of 2008. And we're still, in some ways, coming out of that, and many people are certainly still feeling it. Now it appears that there's a lot of subprime lending on auto loans, and that you think is a problem. Why do lenders in the auto industry feel comfortable lending money to people who are a credit risk, as we've just discussed, in a way that home lenders are now not supposed to and in many cases are not doing?
Right. And a lot of that, so the first question is, why would you even want to give that money? You've got to remember that that money is packaged into securities that's sold in the marketplace. And in a low yield environment right now, you can get higher yield. The other thing is these things can be packaged into AAA securities based on past payment history. So that's another reason why people might be buying them. But most importantly is actual behavior that occurred in the Great Recession. Here's what we know about what people did. We know that the last thing they were going to default on was their automobile loan. They would walk away from their mortgage before their automobile loan, and they would walk away from their credit cards before their automobile loan. And when you think about it, that makes sense, because if that's how you're either going to keep your job or maybe get a new job, that becomes your number one payment that you have to make. So part of the reason more money is being made available is during a horrible collapse and an increase in unemployment. The repayment history on automobile loan for subprime folks was actually pretty darn good.
That's interesting. So it is in some ways a safer bet for the lenders in the auto industry than some other types of loans. But you're also concerned about auto loans that are 84-month loans or very long-term, you know, six, seven-year loans. Why? I mean, that seems like a great way to space it out if you're buying a new car.
Well, the reason for it is you have a long period of time where you're underwater, where you're going to owe more on the vehicle because of the extension of the time period of debt. So that underwater makes it difficult for you if there's the car breaks down or something of that nature to actually pay it back. So let me give you one great example, that Credit Builders Alliance. They estimate that an individual with a pretty good FICO score, which is what I'd recommend, you want a FICO score of about a 720.
Out of a top of 850.
Yeah, out of a top of 850, and the bottom is it's either 300 or 350. I think it's 300, and so pretty wrong range. To get good credit, you want to be around 700, 720, preferably above 720, and so if you assume you have a FICO score of 720, you're going to pay about $4,000 less for a $10,000 loan. That's a 5-year auto loan. So that works out to be about a savings of $67 a month compared to somebody who's subprime with a score of 600. So, you know, you have this big variability, and that gives you an idea of the cost of bad credit, particularly with automobile loans. So someone's getting a nice low rate and someone might be paying 6% more because they have bad credit.
Yeah, and that's a very large number for a $10,000 loan to have the difference be somebody paying $4,000 more over the course of that loan than somebody with good credit.
Oh, absolutely. And so, you know, what people look at when they're buying an automobile, I think they do what I do. You think about, you know, you think about it in terms of what's that monthly payment, what can I afford to pay? But you're not really thinking about how much is the interest rate that I'm paying that's embedded in that monthly payment. It's kind of hidden. They tell you what the APR is, but you maybe don't realize the aggregate dollar amount. And so, you know, if 6 months or a year before you're buying a new automobile or you're looking for a home, if you can improve your credit score, that can pay you, you know, a lot of money. Another example is, you know, on the mortgage side, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau just put up on their website this great site that allows you to literally look at Vermont and what rates are given based on your credit score. So, and you can't go below 620 because you're non-conforming. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac won't buy your loans. So you can't get a loan below 620 credit score. But you could say, here's my credit score. What does that mean for me? And when you look at a $200,000 loan in about 80% loan, so you put 20% down, what you look at is a lifetime payment or a 30-year loan payment of about $50,000, $60,000 more in interest if you have bad credit than if you have good credit. And so people don't realize that you know they're going to pay a lot in interest. But if they focus on improving their credit scores, they're going to reduce how much more they pay.
We're talking today about credit card debt, debts, lending, loans, how much you have in debt. We're interested in hearing about it. if you have maybe close to the $10,000 in average credit card debt for Vermonters, why? What got you to that number? Where do you fall on that list, and how do you manage your debt? Are you struggling just to pay the minimum balance? Are you able to find a way to be disciplined about spending down your debt? Do you have no debt? And maybe that's not the best way to do it. So what's the right average for you, and how are you learning these lessons about credit and debt? You can give us a call and tell us. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. All right, so that number, nearly $10,000 in average credit card debt. Some people have a lot less, some people have a lot more. That's how averages work. We know that.
Yeah.
It seems massive, but it's actually a little bit less than the national average. What's actually contributing to that debt for most Vermonters?
It's hard to know, really. It's hard to know what they're spending it on. The question really is it needs versus wants? Is it things that they have to have, other impulse purchases? Things of that nature. I mean, a great one I use with some of the students is if you go and buy an iPad and you have to have it now. So instead of waiting and saving the $500 or $600 to buy the iPad, you have to have it right now. And you buy it on a credit card that has about an 18% interest payment on it, and you just pay the monthly. And a lot of times the minimum monthly on something as low as $500 could be $20 a month. It will take you by the time you finish paying it off 4 years later, not only has your $500 iPad become like an $800 or $900 iPad, but by the time you pay it off, you need a new iPad because it's going to take you 4 years or 3.5 years. So it depends. If people are paying the minimum, you can see how you can really get into a bad situation, because the minimum, depending on your balance, doesn't even pay the interest. So each month, if you just pay the minimum, you get in trouble. And there's now this box called the Schumer box for Chuck Schumer that's on your credit card bill, and it shows you how long it would take if you just paid that minimum. And those can be pretty scary numbers.
I can see, though, some Vermonters, I mean, it's difficult, as you said, to be able to parse apart the numbers and what they mean. But, you know, in those statistics that I read at the very beginning, 21% of Vermonters are spending more than their income. 34% of Vermonters live paycheck to paycheck. Those aren't necessarily the same people, but
right.
You can see how poverty or feeling like you're very close to the margins might lead you to spend more than you're making. You know, one car repair can send you right over the edge.
Absolutely.
Do you see people just trying to sort of move debt around? So you might have a bill that you need to pay for a car repair, but you're paying for it with a credit card because you don't have the income. I mean, are people doing that, just sort of moving things around without ever actually paying down their debt?
I think I would think the answer to that is yes. There's definitely a portion of our population, probably more significant than we realize, that they have to make these tough choices. And sometimes when it becomes some sort, almost like a death spiral, right? Because you can never pay it off because it keeps growing if you're only paying the minimums with regard to an interest rate like 18%. I mean, even just thinking about 18%, when the federal government can get a 10-year loan through a treasury, right? They borrow from us, we buy the bonds, and they're paying us less than 3%, or actually less than 2% right now. And meanwhile, the banks are charging us 18% on a credit card or more. It could be much more if you have really bad credit ratings. So that's the problem. But they're definitely doing that. The other thing I point out is that $9,000 number is an average of everybody.
Right.
So based on federal statistics I've seen, if you just do the average of people who have credit card debt, it's probably more like $15,000.
Mm.
So because remember, your point was over 40% of people pay off their credit cards
right.
every month in the state, and it's even higher than that. It's over 50% nationally. So the credit card companies aren't making money off of the people who pay off their credit cards every month. They're making their money off of the folks who aren't.
We're talking today about credit and debt. Nearly half of Vermont adults have a subprime credit rating. That affects whether or not they can get a loan and what kind of rates they can get. But it can also have an impact on other parts of their lives. Employers are sometimes looking at the credit history of potential employees before they make a hiring decision. And young people with a lot of student loan debt are postponing home buying, making different job decisions, sometimes even postponing marriage because of the debt burden they carry. You can tell us your story and what lessons you've learned about credit and debt. We're going to answer some of your questions coming right up. Our number is 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We've been talking with John Pelletier, director of Champlain College's Center for Financial Literacy, about the basics of credit ratings and debt, particularly credit card debt. And we're joined now by Stephanie Struble, senior assets manager at Opportunities Credit Union, a nonprofit organization. Stephanie, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And listeners, while they can't give you detailed financial advice, they are financial educators, not financial advisors. They are eager to share their insight into how to manage credit card debt and to help people avoid some of the pitfalls of others. So if you have a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Stephanie, before we get into some of the listener questions, let me just ask you, from your position at Opportunities Credit Union, what are people coming in and asking you about? What are the concerns that they have about debt and borrowing when they come in and talk with you?
The majority of the people that we see right now that are coming in are people that are in crisis and in debt and really asking, how do I get out of this? How do I get out of it? How do I be smarter? And how do I get the education that I need that this doesn't happen again? And a lot of them are young adults. Some of them are parents with children who want to educate their children so they're not going through the same financial troubles that they're having right now.
Do you find that people really do have a lack of understanding about these things?
Yeah, it's incredible. But yeah, there is a large lack of understanding. And it's, yeah, I don't think it's uncommon. I think if you were to get a look at a credit card statement and try to understand and read it, it's confusing and it is hard to understand.
Mm-hmm. So is the lack of education or understanding because they're not being taught any of these skills, or because the financial world moves quickly and there are different ways that the lenders are doing things that are confusing to people?
I think it's both. I think it's really difficult for the average consumer to stay on top of all of the regulations. I think that their education in the school system is important. And in the colleges now, I think it's mandatory, should be mandatory. And I think especially even in a younger age, grade school and going forward, teaching your kid to save creates really good habits.
You think that's true, John?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's. I mean, it's not taught. You know, when we did the task force, what we found is we know it's not being taught in many of our schools, or if it is being taught, it's being taught as an elective, which means most people don't even have a chance to take it. So only 7 out of 65 high schools in the state require it as a graduation requirement. So it's not being taught there. We know it's not being taught at home. In fact, you know, Schwab did a survey of parents, and they found out they were nearly as uncomfortable talking to their parents about personal finance as they are as talking about sex. You know, so the sex talk and money is about the same. That's a bit disconcerting. And it's not really required in college. In most colleges, all you get is the entrance and exit talks if you're getting student loans, which, you know, more than 2/3 of students do. Nationally.
I had an interesting conversation with a high school student recently who was involved in trying to get curriculum around some of these issues, how to apply for student loans, how to deal with credit cards. And he said that there was a lot of interest in it when he was getting it started. And then once the class was up and running, students don't want to take it. You know, it's not sexy. It's not fun when you're a student and you're thinking, really, you're going to tell me about, you know, APIs and APRs, that's not fascinating stuff.
Right.
But it is something that, as we have discovered, everybody needs to know. And certainly our listeners are interested in this, too, because the phone is lighting up with people who have questions, who have thoughts. Brendan works in financial services. He wrote in with these comments. Debt is like an antibiotic. When it's used prudently, it's a very powerful tool in the process of maintaining health. When it's used without care, it can lead to the growth of superbugs that eat you alive. On the personal side, borrowing to fund lifestyle consumption is generally not sustainable and will inevitably lead to lost opportunity or worse. On the other hand, borrowing to increase one's rate of saving or investing can be a very effective strategy. And we'll talk a little bit about that, because certainly borrowing is not only a bad thing. It's something that's out there for people to use as a tool that can, in some cases, be the only way you're going to buy a house, for example. Mm-hmm. Scott asks, I wonder if there's any relationship between easy credit and stagnant wages, meaning has the availability of easy credit been a good excuse to keep wages down? If so, isn't that a vicious circle that we have created? Either of you have thoughts on that? The debt to wages?
Yeah, I haven't. I mean, if anything, our wages have gone down or been stagnant. And since the crisis, I would say credit's less readily available. That wasn't the case prior to 2007. But there's some connection there. But correlation's not causation. Mm-hmm. I really don't know. I haven't seen a study that would point that there's causation.
Stephanie, any thoughts on that from you?
What I try to explain to people when they come in and they're looking to get credit, it's a very different way of looking at credit. People have a very hard time, I think, understanding what's affordable, because I think they're told what they can afford. By maybe a lending institution or a credit card or whomever. And that's just, for me, really not the reality. I think as consumers, we have to be smarter on what we know we can afford and kind of stick to that.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, I've had some young people tell me that if a credit card company gave them a $3,000 credit limit, that means I can spend $3,000.
Right.
That's not what it means.
Yeah.
And so that's a bit of a problem, is getting people to understand the appropriate uses of credit. And I thought Brendan's point on lifestyle, to finance your lifestyle on a credit card at 20% interest rate so you can take a trip to Cancun, probably isn't a good idea.
Right. I mean, credit cards, what we try to really emphasize at the credit union too, is credit cards are meant for convenience. They are not to supplement your income. And so if you get a credit card and it's got a limit and you know you're going to be spending $300 a month using it for gas or groceries, then you need to budget for that and pay that off at the end of the month. So really for convenience, not to supplement income.
Our number, if you have a question about this subject matter, we're talking about debt and credit, our number is 1-800-639-2211. You can also share your lessons learned. Go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. Let's go to Mark, who's calling in from Southbridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I happen to be one of those people that abuse credit cards, living a lifestyle that I really should not have been living. I was fortunate enough to pay them all off, and it's been about 14 years since I've had a credit card. I also own my own home. I own two homes. I don't have any credit card. I don't have any debt. Is that going to hurt me in the long run?
Mark, interesting question. John Pelletier, what about that? Mark is in a great position of having no debt, but he also doesn't have any credit cards and doesn't have anything that it sounds like is sort of building credit for him.
Yeah, there's two things going on in his conversation, right? One is repairing credit. You had bad credit. You fixed it. And then the question then becomes credit building. And I would probably turn to our other expert here, but it's not clear to me what your credit score would look like after 14 years, because if you have literally no credit, if he has a mortgage, he has credit.
Yeah, and it sounds like he doesn't. He's no debt, so he's got those houses free.
No debt's fine if you had mortgages and paid them off.
Yeah.
But it's not bad to have credit cards.
Yeah,
if you don't use them.
Talk about that, because we've sort of demonized credit cards, right. But they are out there for people to use.
And credit repair really indicates that your credit history needs attention in specific areas, such as late payments, you've maxed out your credit line, you have charged off debt. Credit building can be for both people that have had no credit or actually have good credit, but their score isn't where they want it to be. It could be that they need some diversity in their credit history, say an auto loan, a mortgage, a credit card, installment debt, revolving debt, mix it up a little bit. Because when you're looking at banks and institutions, and everybody kind of looks at how you pay in different scenarios. So revolving debt, your payment's going to go up and down. Installment debt, it's going to be the same. So they're kind of looking for some diversity in the credit history.
Yeah, because the other thing you have is what I'll call invisible credit, people who don't have a credit score, and they need to build credit. And there was an article I came across. The statistic in the New York Times shocked me because I didn't realize it was this high. They said 54 million people in the United States don't have a credit score.
And why? Because they've never had a credit card, they've never had any debt, they don't own any auto loans or home loans.
So let me ask you, with college students,
and
too.
What's the problem with that? If you don't ever plan to have any debt, why do you need to build your credit?
because I think it's good to have a, I view it as, at a minimum, I'd want to have a credit card, you know, kind of break the glass in case of an emergency. That if you know, I have a health issue, or I have a car repair, an auto repair, something of that nature, I think to have a pool of money that you can get your hands on quickly, particularly if you're that secure and that focused on making sure you don't get into trouble, it's a great thing to have. It's like you can have a home equity line and never draw it down either. That's maybe not a bad thing. So the credit itself can be almost like an insurance policy, but you don't have to use it unless there's an emergency.
So if you're trying to build credit, Stephanie, would it be wise maybe to have a credit card, maybe use it for some purchases every month that you know you're going to use it for, if you also then budget in your income to know that you can pay it down? Is that a smart thing to
do? Well, my recommendation for anybody that's trying to rebuild or build credit is really to seek out a financial educator so that they really understand the value of the credit and also the problems that they can run into it. So, yeah, I think, you know, education is a huge part. Small cards, retail cards, gas cards with a low limit, small purchases, no big ticket items. If they can budget that in and they can do it that way, there are secured credit cards that you can get at lending institutions that secure the card. You know, young adults, I often tell the parents to be an authorized signer on your parent card. It's called piggybacking, but what it allows is it allows the parent to monitor their spending habits, and it kind of gives, you know, the young adult a boost in their credit rating. And then when they're ready, they've already had some experience on how those credit cards and that credit works.
Mm-hmm. And that is often one of the ways that if you have no credit rating, you sort of have to have a signer, co-signer, don't you? Oftentimes, if you're either a young person or somebody who's just come to this country, you maybe don't have a credit score in this country, mm-hmm. you often need a co-signer just to get a credit card.
Well, I'm not an advocate on having people co-sign. I do the opposite. If you have good credit and you want to keep good credit, I would say never co-sign. I think there's other ways to build credit. And again, that's when I would seek somebody that, you know, a financial educator.
Let's go to Beth, who's on the line with us from Rutland. Hi, Beth. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks. I have two questions. The first one is, who gave employers permission to look at a future employee's credit rating? Is that the federal government or the state government? And I find that to be intrusive, but it also means you might have an employee for life. The second question is, would you explain what secured credit cards are? And I'll listen off the air.
Beth, thanks for the call. John, let's go to you first here on that issue of, can employers look at your credit rating?
Yeah, generally it's when you go and you fill out an employee application, the application may give them the right to do that. And there was a survey of human resource professionals, and 47% of them said, businesses that responded said, you know, we look at it. Now, we might only look at it with regard to specific jobs that come in contact with money or those sorts of things. I came from the financial services industry. It was required. I mean, if you're a bank or you're a mutual fund company or something of that nature, everyone needs to go through that because there's a risk of fraud and theft.
But I'll say it's beyond the financial industry. I, working only in public media, have had my credit score checked by employers in the past as well.
Yeah. What I would say is this. The good thing is in Vermont in 2012, we passed a bill. It's limited to very specific situations as to when you can look at credit. And we're one of, I think, only 10 states that have done that. So it is in other states, it's even worse. There are no limits whatsoever. But literally, when you fill out that application form because you want that job and you sign on the bottom, if you read the fine print, you're letting them do a criminal check and a financial check on you.
And Stephanie, just very quickly, you mentioned secured credit cards. Can mm-hmm. you just explain what that is?
Secured credit cards are really secured credit that are backed by a savings. So again, you know, for young adults coming into the world, if in the credit, you can go to a lending institution and you can put $500 in your savings. They kind of freeze it. They secure it. And they're allowed to use that credit card. And if you default on that credit card, that money will pay off that credit card. But that's not to say that if you misuse that credit card, there will be a negative impact on your history.
Well, this is really interesting. I appreciate both of you being here. Certainly not our only financial literacy conversation in the past, and certainly we'll have more going forward. Stephanie Struble is a senior assets manager at Opportunities Credit Union. John Pelletier is director of Champlain College's Center for Financial Literacy. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
And we have links at vpr.net to some of the tools that we've been talking about. You can go there for more resources. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In the Rutland area, the name Lenny Burke is well known. But thanks to a new book by Yvonne Daly called A Bend in the Road, Lenny Burke's remarkable story of overcoming a traumatic brain injury is being rediscovered by a whole new generation. As VPR's Nina Keck reports, many are only just now realizing the tremendous impact Burke and his mother Emmy have had on TBI treatment in Vermont and beyond.
Mount St. Joseph's Academy in Rutland has hosted hundreds of basketball games, like this one, over the years. But for this story, we're going back to one particular game that MSJ hosted in 1979. Lenny Burke was a 17-year-old senior and star forward who dreamed of playing college ball. He was a natural athlete and gifted student. Middlebury and UVM had already accepted him for their pre-med programs the following year. But everything changed that January day, 36 years ago. Lenny was leaping toward the basket trying to score when a player from the other team rammed into his legs and undercut him. Lenny's mother, Emmy Burke, was in the stands and saw her son crash headfirst to the floor.
He did try to stand up. And I know in his mind he was wanting to make that shot because he knew he was fouled. But of course, the subdural hematoma came so fast that he couldn't stand up.
There was an unnatural hush in the stand, she says. Everyone just sat there stunned, watching as Lenny was taken out to a waiting ambulance.
I really did not know the seriousness of his injury. I had never heard of TBI, or it was called head injury at that time. I'd never heard of it, so I just didn't know what to do or how we should handle it, and relied totally on the doctors.
Local doctors did all they could, but they weren't optimistic, and Lenny remained in a coma for 45 days. During that time, Emmy says she willed her son to breathe and read everything she could get her hands on that had to do with brain injuries.
I didn't find much of anything. The doctors were kind enough to let me go into the library and take a look, and I remember picking up a book that said The Shattered Mind. And it was all written in lingo that I did not understand. I was a mom, period. And I didn't know anything about traumatic brain injury except for one article that I had read in the Ladies' Home Journal.
The article had described a new technique for head injury victims that called for lowering the person's body temperature and increasing their oxygen. Emmy mentioned it to the local neurologist who promised to look into it.
And he went home and read about it and put Lenny on that method. So what it did was relieve some of the pressure of the brain and save some of the neurons and things that are very important.
It would be the first of many instances where Emmy took the lead in her son's recovery.
Emmy is one of the most impressive people I've ever met in my life, not only in terms of her resiliency and not letting go of things, but searching everything out. And she was never afraid to try something.
That's Rutland native Ron Savage.
At the time that Lenny was injured, I was a special education teacher. And when Lenny was injured, there was everybody was just trying to figure out, what do we do about it?
The community rallied, raising nearly $100,000, an unbelievable amount of money at the time. When Lenny finally awoke from his coma and began to speak, Savage says people were thrilled.
We all thought that with that money, we're going to send Lenny across the country to California, the only place at the time that worked with people with head injuries. And we all thought, to be quite honest with you, that if we sent him out there, that he was going to come back fixed, if you will. That's not the way he came back.
Savage says Lenny returned to Rutland with huge problems and few answers as to how to overcome them.
And that's sort of the area that no one had really investigated whatsoever. We knew how to save lives. We had a little bit of rehabilitation here and there, but no one was doing afterwards, a year afterwards, 2 years afterwards? What do you do 30 years afterwards?
Emmy had gone to California with Lenny and had peppered the rehabilitation staff there with questions and watched everything they did closely so she could care for her son when she brought him home.
The doctors did set us up with a psychiatrist who said to me, "You've done it once, you can do it again. Just being a mother, just take care of him with your instincts and do what you need to do." So that was really good advice, and it wasn't daunting. I knew I could do that.
Emmy and her husband had three other younger children, and she says the entire family helped with Lenny's recovery. But it was a long haul, filled with frustrating ups and downs for her oldest child.
He had a long streak of inappropriate behavior, and that was the most difficult part. And we watched him all the time to see, what is he saying now? And it became really stressful for all of us.
But Emmy was determined. She wanted Lenny to return to high school and have a life. So she called Ron Savage, who she knew taught special education. Savage wanted to help, but admits he felt daunted by how much he didn't know about brain injuries. So he began reading. He says he was shocked by the lack of material.
It surprised me because we knew about this population from World War II. There were studies of thousands and thousands of men who came back with head trauma, and certainly from Vietnam. But no one was sort of writing up what works, what do you do, what's the evidence, is this the best practice, what types of therapies, modalities are going to help this person to improve their functioning.
Savage's research took his career in a whole new direction, and today he's one of the nation's leading experts on traumatic brain injury, heading up a pediatric brain injury rehabilitation school in New York City, chairing the International Pediatric Brain Injury Society, and serving as a past chairman of the North American Brain Injury Society. He says everything he's done in the field, he can trace back to Lenny and the early work he and Emmy began in Rutland.
What happened with Emmy and I, we started getting calls from other families that said, "I also have a child with a brain injury. I also have a spouse with a brain injury." And it was like one call after another call after another call. And Emmy and I were literally sitting around one time talking, and I said, "You know, there needs to be like an organization. There needs to be outreach. There's not just one Lenny Burke. There's a lot more." And of course, Emmy, you know, felt the same way. And Emmy's thing is, well, then this thing needs to be built and formed.
With help from a small grant, they created a statewide organization called the Head Injury Stroke Independence Project, HIS for short.
Within no time whatsoever, here's Emmy and Lenny getting in the car, and they're driving all over Vermont to meet with parents and people who have had brain injuries, and they're helping them.
That's Yvonne Daly, whose new book, The Bend in the Road, chronicles Lenny's journey.
And they're finding what resources are in their neighborhoods, in their schools, and they're working with them to try and brainstorm with them ways to keep young people, for example, from living the rest of their lives in nursing homes.
Daly writes that in the first 4 years, the HIS support group helped more than 500 families.
And this led to Emmy and Lenny together realizing that what most people needed was to be at home or in an apartment that they could manage, or if they couldn't, to live in a facility that was like a home. And that's how we got Lenny Burke's farm.
In 1987, Emmy bought an old farmhouse and barn in Wallingford. Daly writes that turning it into a residential treatment facility was a huge undertaking, but Emmy trusted her instincts, and many in the Rutland community pitched in to help. 2 months after they opened, Lenny Burke's farm had its first client. That was 27 years ago.
Today, Lenny Burke's farm has 5, soon to be 6 facilities, serving about 25 people in-house with full-time residential treatment. And then we have about an equal number of folks who are in their own apartments, in jobs, throughout the community that we provide services for as well.
That's Kevin Burke.
I'm the co-director of Lenny Burke's farm, have been for many years. Most importantly, I'm Lenny's brother.
Kevin says when his mom first came up with the idea of creating home-like settings for people with brain injuries, it was pretty unheard of. but he says now it's widely regarded as a highly successful, more cost-effective model of care. Kathy Chandler has worked at Lenny Burke's farm for 15 years.
I always say it's the most real place I've ever worked. It's real life, it's home, it's, you know, it's therapeutic and family.
At one of the group homes in Wallingford, staff members move a long table out of the kitchen and bring in folding chairs. On Thursdays, the weekly support group starts with a sing-along that attracts both current and former clients.
Well, thanks for coming. It's so good to see you, Judy. Okay, hey, how are we doing? Is everybody here?
One of the residents reclines on a stretcher. Others rely on walkers or canes. You can hear the faint hiss of an oxygen machine mingling with the jokes and laughter, the teasing and chatting.
Yeah. What's everybody want to do? Does anybody want to sing a song?
Gary Wade, one of the lead staff members, works the room with a guitar slung over his shoulder.
Somebody want to pick one out?
Yes.
Bones, what do you want to do, Bones? Does that mean you want to do your song? Yeah, man, I want to hear your voice today.
Bones, whose real name is Christopher, sits in a specialized wheelchair and watches Gary with a huge grin. He can't speak, so uses a computer-generated system to answer.
Yes.
Almost heaven, West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountain, Shenandoah River. Life is older, older than the trees, younger than the mountains, growing like a breeze, country road.
The music is just so therapeutic, it's just beyond words. I mean, we have people with expressive aphasia that, you know, can't talk, but they can sing right along. And we've seen their speech increasing with that. It's just amazing that the peacefulness that it creates and the support of everybody.
Since 1987, Lenny Burke's farm has worked with hundreds of people who are coping with brain injuries, something Lenny himself finds hard to believe.
It's amazing to me when I hear that we have all these places. I know we do. And I can even remember now that we do, but it almost boggles my mind to realize how many people we're helping and how many places we're doing it. And it's wonderful. This is why God has me here. This is why I survived my injury.
Ron Savage says the positive ripple effects go far beyond Vermont. Historically, he says teachers didn't consider traumatic brain injury when assessing a child for special education. But thanks to Lenny's experience, that's changed.
Because what we're finding out from our national studies is a lot of kids are injured before they enter school. Shaken babies, three-year-olds that take bad falls.
Savage wrote the first textbook on how to help kids with TBI do better in school, and he pushed hard to ensure federal funding.
So because of Lenny and because of our work in Washington, D.C., a group of us were able to get traumatic brain injury added into the national special education laws.
Something he says Senator Robert Stafford, a Rutland-born lawmaker keenly interested in education, helped spearhead.
That's why I like the Lenny Burke story so much, because we all know that bad things roll downhill. But good things also roll downhill and can spread. And this is one of those stories where, you know, it was an extraordinary family, you know, and that family was just remarkable. But then it was everybody sort of within Lenny's inner circle. And then it spread outside there, and it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. So this was, from my viewpoint, ground zero, because the Lenny Burke story is the story of how we finally understood the significance of brain injury in this country. And a lot of good things have come out of it. That's what's really fascinating.
Savage says the importance of their work continues now. The issue is resonating with the public because so many U.S. military veterans are being diagnosed with TBI, and the dangers of concussion in sports are now more clearly understood. 1 million new traumatic brain injury cases are diagnosed in the U.S. every year. Savage calls it a silent epidemic, but thanks to Lenny, he says it's one we're now understanding much better. For VPR News, I'm Nina Keck.
Today. take me home, country roads.
All right. Oh, yeah.
Good job, everybody.
You can see photos and excerpts from Yvonne Daly's book, A Bend in the Road, Lenny Burke's Farm, on our website, vpr.net. On a related note, next week we'll look at an event called the Vermont Brain Bee. It encourages high school students to learn about neuroscience, and one of the champions of the project is also a Vermonter who has survived a traumatic brain injury. That's it for today's show. Tomorrow, what's next for healthcare reform in the wake of Governor Shumlin's decision to pull the plug on single payer? We'll talk with Green Mountain Care Board Chairman Al Gobay about the work the board continues to do and its goals. Send your questions or comments about the future of healthcare reform to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Our producers are Patty Daniels and Rick Singeri. We have production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Peter Biello directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.